The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Miriam Spector. I'm a member of the Board of the Directors and chair of the Pepper Society, which is our annual giving society that supports all the wonderful things that go on here every day at the Free Library, from small business counseling to after-school homework to great author events like the one you have come to hear today with David Grossman. I'm going to ask you now, please, as you know, to turn off your cell phones. But once you hear Mr. Grossman's presentation and you have bought your book and had it signed upstairs and leave the Free Library, please turn your phones back on and email all your friends and text and tweet, that's for you Barrack students, all of your friends and tell them what a wonderful afternoon you spend at the Free Library. David Grossman is the author of several novels, a series of books and plays for children, as well as two nonfiction books that put faces to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, The Yellow Wind, and Sleeping on a Wire. I can remember the excitement and the serious discussion that The Yellow Wind engendered among those of us who read that provoking and inspiring book in 1987. He received his first literary prize in 1983 and has received numerous others since then. Mr. Grossman has also received several prizes in recognition of his efforts to enhance understanding between Arabs and Jews and between religious and secular Jews. An exploration of the bonds of family and the costs of war, Grossman's new novel, To the Ends of the Land, follows Orah, an Israeli woman who journeys away from home in order to avoid her son's likely death while serving in a major military offensive. The New York Times Book Review said, "It is a testament to Grossman's novelistic talent, indeed perhaps to his genius, that To the End of the Land manages to create and dramatize a world that gives both the reality and the echo their full due. He weaves the essences of private life into the tapestry of history with deliberate and delicate skill. He has created a panorama of breathtaking emotional force, a masterpiece of pacing, of dedicated storytelling, with characters whose lives are etched with extraordinary vivid detail." I have been overwhelmed by this book. Powerful praise for a powerful writer. We're excited to have him here today. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Grossman.
Shalom. Shalom. I'm glad to be here after 9 years that I have not been here. I'll start by telling you a little about this book, To the End of the Land. And thank you, Miriam, for your warm words. I started writing it in 2003. You have to forgive me. I'm a little jet-lagged. I just landed a day ago, and my English is the first thing to evade me. I started writing it after a decade in which I was writing stories about families, about love, about jealousy, about homeless children in Jerusalem, about Samson, the biblical hero. I insisted on writing in the most intimate way about the most intimate things. I felt that so much of our life and energy is being confiscated by the situation. So much of our energies are pouring towards the direction of the conflict, the occupation, terrorism. We turn and tune our attention to the borders of our being, to what separates or buffers between us and our neighbors, us and our enemies. And I felt that there is this danger that we shall end up like a suit of armor without the knight, the person within. And I felt I want to write about the person within. And therefore I wrote all these books, and at the same time I was quite active politically. I wrote many essays and I wrote all kind of documents, political documents, and I took part in the team that formulated the Geneva Accord, the agreement between us and the Palestinians. And all the time I was looking for a way to combine writing about the bigger sphere of our reality and the intimate sphere. And I felt I am unable to find it. I felt that whenever I wrote something about the situation that we call in Hebrew hamatzav, which is a nice, clean way to describe the constant bleeding of the last century, hamatzav. Whenever I wrote about hamatzav, about the situation, I felt like writing a cliché. I felt like using words and formulation that have been used by others before me. And then suddenly, in the middle of 2003, I felt that I found the story. And I started writing about Ora. Ora, who in Hebrew, the name Ora means light, Or. And she's a woman of, she's 50 years old, more or less. And she lives separately from her husband, Ilan. And they have two children who are already grown up. Adam, who is already 23, he's out of the army. And Ofer, who is about to finish his military service very soon. And he served in the most difficult places, in the occupied territories, in roadblocks. And Ora decides that in order to celebrate his being released from the army, both of them, she and him, they will go on a walking tour in the Galilee, in the north of Israel. And she prepares for this tour, and she's so excited because it will give her an opportunity to get back to her son. Because, you know, I don't know if you know, but Israel is known, when our children go to the army, in a way, they change. They have to change. They have to buffer themselves from where they are, what they have to do. And there is a certain, again, suit of armor that they have to wear in order to protect themselves. And there is always these minutes when the soldier comes back from his military service. He comes back home. And I remember it for myself when I was a soldier, and I remember it for my children when they came back. And they came back from the most unbearable places, and suddenly they enter home, and the home is a home. It's disarmed. It is a civilian place. It's tender and warm and disarmed. And I remember the gaze in their eyes when they looked at it, as if it cannot be. There cannot be such a reality. Even I think they felt that it is dangerous to be so exposed, so naked in front of the cruelty of reality. Ofer, in the story, the soldier is about to leave the army. And Aura waits for this day, and on the day that he is about to get out of the army, a new military operation starts in the occupied territories. And Ofer volunteers to continue his military service, to go there to be with his friends, his comrades. For 3 years, he trained himself exactly for this situation. And now he will not give up on it. He will go. And Aura finds herself after bringing him to the gathering point of the army. And she does it without almost thinking, only being terrified. She starts to have this bad feeling, such intuition regarding what might happen to him. And she brings him to the gathering point, and she comes back home, and she sees the two backpacks that she have packed for him and for her. Together they have packed it the night before. And they stand there. And then she starts to think, and she starts to feel that there is this bad news hovering above her head, which all of us have in such circumstances. But for her, it is even more acute. And then she formulates it to herself that it takes two for bad news, one to deliver and one to receive. And what if she will not be there to receive? And she wants to believe that this machinery of the notifiers will be taken aback for a day, 2 minutes, no more than that. But maybe something will happen in these 2 minutes or a day. Maybe she will be able to reverse the events. And she takes the two backpacks, and she runs away from home, and she orders the driver, the Palestinian taxi driver who drives her, she orders him go to the end of the land, which of course has double meaning, both the physical place where the country ends, but also it refers to this everlasting fear, this subcurrent of anxiety that every Israeli knows and experiences. The fear for the future of this country. But she does not go alone to the end of the land. On her way, she sweeps with her. She almost kidnaps Avram. Avram, who was the love of her life. And when the book starts, we see Orah and Avram and Ilan, who later became her husband. But Avram is her great love. And Avram is like an explosion, a volcano of imagination and of passion and creativity and humor and everything. This is how he was when he was 16, 17, 21. And then when he was 22, as a reservist soldier, he fell captive at the hands of the Egyptians in the 73 war, the Yom Kippur war. And he returned half person, devastated mentally, physically. They really broke his spirit, the Egyptians, in their torments. And he does not want to have anything to do with life. He just does not want to be given to life in any way. But Aura continues to love him and tries to impose life on him. And when she runs away from home, she takes him with her against his will. She has really to force him to come with her. And suddenly they find themselves in the Galilee, up there in the north, alone, wandering. Both of them have no clue how to navigate, how to walk, how to find their way. They don't know anything about it. And they are, in a way, strangers to each other. And she does what she feels she must do, and she starts telling the life story of Ofer to Avram. She tells about all the smallest details, all the minutia of life. You know, it's in a certain point she writes in her notebook while they are walking, she writes, thousands of acts and deeds and efforts and failures and goodwill and mistakes thousands of these it takes in order to create one human being in the world, to accumulate one human being in life, one human being that is, it is so easy to destroy, of course. But she feels that now when Ofer, her son, is there in the battlefield, the only thing that she can do in order to envelop him is to actively tell his life story with all these details. And she keeps telling Avram about all these small moments that we all remember and cherish from our own childhood or from the experience of us being parents. The first moment in which Ofer stood up on his feet. What a wonderful moment of revelation it is, that all the perspective changes of what the child sees, what he hears, all the new world that is being revealed to him. Or the moments at night when she breastfed him, and this intimacy of the mother and the child, and the way she felt, how she is imprinted in the pupils of his eyes, because he looked at her in a way that I think no other diada is, no other couple can look at this moment when the baby is being breastfed by the mother, and look at her eyes, and she feels that she was never more beautiful than in this moment, and that she is imprinted in his eyes forever. And she describes how she sits with Ofer when he's 10 years old and he is very weak at mathematics, and she teaches him, and she herself doesn't know much. And all these familial scenes that we all know. And at a certain point, Avram comes back to life. At a certain point, something in the story or the storytelling of Ora lures him back to life. And even if we do not know if Ora managed to save her son, and I tell it to you right now, I mean, it's not a detective book that you have to solve a mystery. It's an open ending, and I wanted it to be like that from the very beginning, because I thought every ending or every, you know, firm ending will be artificial. But what I can tell you is that she manages to bring Avram back to life and commit him to life again. And I wanted this story, as I said, to tell not only about the conflict, but about the wonder of family. And I think that the greatest drama of humanity is the drama of the family. And each and every one of us is a participant in such a drama, for each of us is born to a family, no matter what the circumstances are. Even if the family was totally absent, still it is his or her family. And I always think that the greatest moment in the history of mankind, they have not occurred on battlefields or in palaces or in corridors of parliaments, but rather in kitchens and in bedrooms and in rooms of children. And in this book, I tried to merge the two and to show how the outer conflict of the Middle East or any other long and violent conflict, how it projects itself, radiates itself into this intimate bubble of tenderness and compassion of family, and how it alters its innermost texture, inevitably, how it changes it, sometimes tear it to pieces. And the book takes place while walking. They walk and they talk. I call it the walkie-talkie book, because they walk and they talk, and in the beginning, as I said, they are totally alienated from the surrounding. But gradually, as long as Avram is being opened into the story of Ora, he's being more and more open to life around him. And it takes place in the Galilee, the north of Israel, which is wonderful. It's a beautiful part of Israel. Israel is a very small country, as you probably very well know, but there are so many dramatic and different and diverse landscapes in this small piece of land. And Galilee is certainly a very, very beautiful place. And I always think that if Avram and Orah had to go to a psychologist to cope with the problems, it would have taken them 10 years, I think, at least. But being in the out, being in the nature, and especially in the generosity of the Galilee, immediately it acted upon them. And this is something I always feel myself when I walk in the Galilee. I always tell my wife, I'm a better person when I'm in the Galilee. To which she answers, why won't you go there more often? Yes. I walked for 500 kilometers along the Israeli trail. You know, we have this trail that goes through the most beautiful parts of Israel. I did it, and this was the best part of writing this book. Being there alone, most of the time I walked alone. I walked several days with friends and with my wife, but I noticed that whenever I walk with someone else, I'm more tuned to the radiation of the other human being and not to nature. And when two people walk, they talk and they make noises, so animals are running away from them. When you walk alone, it gives you this feeling of being just another creature of nature. And the people that I met on the trail, on the path, or in the path, they were, you know, many of them were people that had we met in any other circumstances in Israel, it would have evolved immediately into a political, very hot and sharp debate. Again, being in the nature, in the open, allowed us to be much more flexible, much more open to each other. You know, and you sit and you make coffee and you exchange sandwiches or biscuits and you talk like two human beings. And I think that I try to bring some of these energies especially into the character of Orah. And I think this what made the book accepted in such a wonderful way in Israel. The fact that Orah is not someone from the left wing or the right wing. She's not entrenched in one political view. You know, we are all entrenched back there in Israel. One becomes a prisoner of one's opinions. And sometimes I think it's easier to change your gender than to change your political views there, to confess that you were wrong. And I remember on the same day I met people in Israel, quite well-known people from the extreme right and the extreme left. And both of them told me, you know, this is our book. And I guess that it is because the book allows this free-floating, allows us to expose ourselves again, as we do not allow ourselves to do, to all the nuances of the situation. Because the situation in which Israel exists is such a complicated, multi-layered situation. And a very firm idea is not suitable for the complexity of the situation. And one has really to fight himself or herself in order, you know, to allow to feel all the contrary feelings. And for a leftist to know that, yes, despite the fact that you are liberal, that you are looking for peace, that all your ideology is a very liberal one, to remember we live in a very belligerent, violent region that have never accepted Israel. To remember it. And to people from the right to allow themselves to feel feelings of guilt towards what we are doing to the Palestinians. It does not weaken our identity, not at all. Nothing is being taken from us. It's only this lousy situation that does not allow you any generosity towards the other, does not allow you even for a second to look at reality from the point of view of the other. And this book, I can say for what it did to me, but probably what it did to many others, was this allowance, this way of accepting the complexity of the situation. And I think when you allow yourself to accept this way of looking at reality, suddenly you understand how really tragic our situation is there. Not only dangerous, which we all know, but how tragic it is. And how heavy is the fee we all pay for living in this reality. And I will say only one more thing, and then you can ask your questions if you have any. For me, writing is the most intimate act. Almost the most intimate act. Well, there are some other intimate acts, yeah. But it is, especially in a situation that is so crushing, so dominant, so invasive to every private space, so much of our life is being taken by the situation. And to live all your life in such situation of violence, situation of war, and war by its nature dehumanizes you, no matter what you will do. Century of war has terrible effects on the soul of a people, of the collective, and of the soul of the individual. It creates a climate of hatred, of suspicion, of indifference and cruelty and apathy and fatalism and fundamentalism. These are all the fruits of this catastrophe zone of war. While writing is just acting in the other way. It is just a way to specify the individual or a group of people and to treat it with ultimate tenderness and attention. I think always there is something almost motherly in the way a writer is attentive to his characters. In the way a writer allows himself to be exposed, to be bare, unprotected in front of the radiation of his characters. And all the act of writing for me, and I'm sure not only for me, but for most of the writers in Israel, is this act of saying I, you know, of reclaiming our individuality from the situation. And again and again, in the book itself, there are such acts of trying to say I, of not collaborating with the brutality of the situation, with the facelessness of the situation. And even in the language that it is written in Hebrew and in the wonderful translation of Jessica Cohen, who keeps getting compliments in all the reviews, I wanted it to be written in a very rich language. Usually I'm writing in a very rich language. But here, I think even more, because it is also a protest against the way our language is being reduced. And it's being reduced because language always serves as a way to touch reality, to explore, to experience reality. And the more nuances you have for your language, the more sensations you can touch in reality. But if reality around you is so harsh and so frightening, and whenever you allow yourself to go out, you are hurt, inevitably one starts to reduce, to narrow down his vocabulary. And it is natural, it's understandable. And again, I think it is part of the heavy fee that we are paying for the situation, because gradually we have no language to approach the complexity of our situation. And again, I understand it. I feel this temptation again. Who wants to describe his nightmare in high resolution. We don't. But I feel that if we collaborate with it, we also have been defeated in this war. And therefore, this book tries to describe with as many nuances as possible everything, the flowers and the animals and the soil and the noise that the feet do when they cross through the bushes, and the colors of the sky, and family scenes, you know, sitting in a restaurant together with the children, and love and sex and relationship between siblings, between the two brothers. Because for me, more than anything, it's a book about the wholeness of life. And it's an attempt to reclaim this wholeness of life that are all the time in danger in Israel. So I didn't mean even to talk so long, and you were very patient, and if you have any questions, I will answer them now. Thank you. Thank you.
So the way this usually works is you raise your hand, we'll get a microphone to you. Mm-hmm. We are here today to discuss literature and would prefer not to focus on the politics. This is a book of emotion and power, and I think if you know David's work, that you'll probably have some good questions in that regard. The gentleman in the red here. Please wait for the microphone, sir.
I'm just interested in all the American references and the way American culture seems to permeate the references in your book. Everything from Rambo to an Indian camp to American music, American writers. And I just wonder about how that permeates Israeli culture and what I can learn about the references.
Interesting question. I was not even aware of that until you said that. But it just shows the depth of American culture, and sometimes American subculture penetrates the Israeli culture. I can testify for the influence in the language, in the way the English becomes more and more present in our life. You know, there are streets in Tel Aviv that the notes on the stores are a direct translation, and sometimes also in English letters, in English words, they are English. You could think that you are in a place that is not Israel if you look only in the notes, or in the way the English infiltrated into the way we speak. How many idioms are there in the Hebrew? Of course, it has to do with the enormous power of the media, of television, and in the way our children are being exposed to it all the time. And I deeply feel, even though I believe that the Hebrew language is flexible enough to absorb many influences from Arabic, from Russian, and from Hebrew, from English, I now feel that we are really on the edge of it. That maybe something is destructive for us. You know, I think if my generation, who were born in the 50s, we still could have read the Bible almost without any translation to modern Hebrew. The generation after us and the generations after us are unable to. They do not have this mastery of the Hebrew language. They do not have all the echoes. They cannot decode the codes of the Bible. And you see how the language shrinks. Regarding American literature, yes, I can think of some books that I mentioned in my book. American literature is very popular in Israel, and this is a good sign for me. I think for the Israeli culture, its openness and Yeah. I mean, with that I have no problem. Only with the effects on the language, the effect on our consumption culture, can you say so? And the effects on our media, which are devastating. I mean, if I think about what the American media did to the way people think, to the way they are able or unable to have multi-layered arguments or way of thinking. You know, the notion, the term mass media was coined by sociologists, I think, in the 30s of the 20th century. And sometimes we think that it says it is a media that is meant to the masses, that is tuned to the masses, but it's not like that. It is a media that turn people into masses, and sometimes even into mob, by its vulgarity, superficiality, self-righteousness, kitsch. It's now a media of kitsch mainly, and it's predominant also in Israel, like it is all over the world.
Another question. Right here on the aisle, the lady in the light blue.
I'm wondering why you spoke in the voice of the mother and not the father, you being a father of Israeli soldiers.
I'm a father of Israeli children, not of Israeli soldiers, to start with. Some reasons. First, I thought that a book that deals so much with raising up of children, with family life, should be told from the point of view of a mother. And I say it, as I said, I was very involved, I am very involved in the life of my children. And yet, the contact between a mother and a child is so primal. I once read in an American scientific magazine that every woman who was pregnant in her life still carries within her body some cells of the fetus. And maybe because of that, Ora is able suddenly to ask, how come I'm more loyal to them, to the army, to the state, to the war, rather than to my own child? A man would have not asked that. You know, I always think of God, when he had this strange idea of the sacrifice of Isaac, he didn't come to Sarah to suggest that. You know, he came to Abraham. I believe that had he come to Sarah, she would have told him, you know, give me a break. He came to Abraham, and he knew why he did it. And he knew the way in which all these big systems of nationalism, of armies, government, war, if we admit it, it's men's games. And I'm not very much expert of the nature or the differences between men and women, but from some women that I met in my life, I know that they always have been more skeptical regarding those men's games. So it had to be Ora, or let's say a man would have collaborated with the system. He would not have run away. It takes Ora to run away. And the last part of the question is because I wanted to write from a point of view of a woman, because one of the great pleasures of writing is this privilege to be another human being. You know, usually in our life, we are so protected from others. We are in a very cunning way, very efficient way, we create all kind of transparent barriers that prevents us to be exposed fully to the chaos that radiates within another human being. And of course, you see it when you talk about enemies. Yes, Israelis and Palestinians, they don't even want to think of the other, to look at the eyes of others. And you can say it's natural, it's logical. I think it's a mistake. It is a mistake. If you allow yourself to look from the side of, from the eyes of your enemy, suddenly the text of reality becomes much more clear and rich, much more real. You are in contact with reality, not only with your own projection of wishful thinking, of your nightmares. You are in touch with reality. You see the way your enemy sees reality. You see where his blind spots are. But you also can be more sensitive to his needs. Maybe you will have the way to redeem him even from his mistakes, also for your own benefit. But we see it also in among couples. You know, of course, present company excluded. Here in Philadelphia, you are angels. I know. I mean, but I'll talk about Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, there are some couples who, I mean, they are married to each other for 30, 40 years, and they are wonderful as couples. And they function well, and they love each other, and they are great parents. And yet, if you look deeply in them, and I have this nasty habit of doing sometimes, you can see almost, you can bereft them of all the layers of time and experience. And suddenly you see the moment in which they were created as a couple. And you can almost see how they stroke a deal. Yeah, they made a bargain not to see this specific other from all his angles. And at the same moment, they promised each other that their love would win at any price, but they also set or fixed the price. Because there is a price for not evocating the wholeness of the most significant person, most significant other. And you can see it between parents and children. You know, we love our children, but do we really want to be exposed to all their dark corners or to the places where suddenly we feel that they are a kind of a caricature even of something that we try to hide and to suppress, and they expose it to the whole world? And sometimes we think, you know, when we make love, we really know the other. Yes, in Biblical Hebrew we say, "V'ha'adam yada et chava ishto." A man knew his wife Eve. Somebody told me he knew her, he did not understand her. But of course, when we make love, we are more tuned to all the beauty and the attractive and the sexy and the sweet elements of our partner. I say it in the most politically correct way. And we reject from our knowledge. We don't want to think of the places where this other is unbearable or tormented or yearning in a way that we cannot respond to. So even in these most intimate moments, we do not really know the other. But when I write a book, a story, I deeply want to know this other. I deeply want to understand what does it mean to be another human being? I don't know it. What is to feel this filament that goes inside another human being that is different from me? And I can tell you, I can do it only through writing. Only when I write, I really get this sensation, this feeling for an hour or some weeks in the course of 5 years of writing a whole novel. But it is such a sweet reward to know it and to be there. So, excuse me for the long answer. You understand now why I don't write haiku poems, but yeah.
All the way in back again on our left. Sir, would you hold your hand up, please? Thank you.
I don't know what time is it. You will listen.
I try to listen to what...
Where is the person who speaks? Ah, okay. Can you stand up? Thank you.
I tried to listen to what you said now. I also listened to you about an hour ago speaking on the radio when you were interviewed. And I appreciate you reflecting on your life. You've led an interesting life. You've also had some sacrifices along the way, and I appreciate you reflecting that in your writing. I do recall that you said you've developed the hobby of hiking in more recent years. You weren't always a hiker. Have you hiked in countries other than Israel? And the other question is, you were given an award in Germany for your work, but you hesitated to go there. I believe you did visit Germany. Have you visited there more than once?
Yes. First of all, I try wherever I am in the world, I try to walk. Sometimes I can do, as I did yesterday, a trek in Manhattan. But if I'm lucky, my publishers allow me to go somewhere in the nature. But the place where I really love to go is Israel. I don't know. It's something very, primal, and I love this landscape. In the north and in the south, in the desert, where it's more dry and deserty. So this is the first answer. Yes, I got the prize only, I think, 40 hours ago in Frankfurt, the Friedens Prize. It's okay. Thank you. I did not hesitate this time. I hesitated the first time when I was invited to Germany. I was afraid of going there. I was born in 54, which is 9 years only after the Shoah, after the Second World War and the Shoah. And all my childhood was marked by this heavy burden. And so many of my memories are from there. And I remember as a child sitting every lunch we ate, and we heard over the radio the daily program of people who were searching for their lost relatives, Amador Lechipus Korvim. And even if we knew that our relatives have been perished, we still were very attentive to hear if maybe one of the names that we knew would be mentioned. And I always feel that my generation lost its appetite, not only for food, but, you know, for a kind of belief or illusion in the good of mankind, or in the power of our parents to protect us, or regarding the future of us, the Jewish people, as a people. And when I first was invited to Germany, it was when I still did not publish any book. I was a radio personality. And I refused to go. And I said, I will come only when my name will be on a book. Because I felt that the thing that frightens me the most, or one of the most, is the fact that people were murdered anonymously, that they were deprived of any personal or intimate quality. People were reduced to the lowest level of flesh and blood. They didn't have names, but numbers tattooed on their arm. They were deprived of their families, friends, talents, secrets, intimacy. Everything was taken away from them. And I felt, if I come with my name on a book, so that the Germans who read my book can understand that everyone who was murdered was the whole world, then it will make it easier on me. And it was not easy. It took me several years until I was able really to be more calm in Germany. And even today, you know, I'll never go to a vacation in Germany. Always I feel a little on duty there. But I also know another thing. I know now quite many young Germans, and they are lovely people, and people that I fully trust and appreciate. And I also see the process that Germany, unlike any other country on earth, is undergoing in the last years. And the way how a nation who came to the bottom of human landscape or option, morally, humanly, the terrible atrocities have been committed by the Germans, and yet they were able to uplift themselves from there and to educate generation after generation on new values of democracy, of anti-militarization, of new morality. And it is a source of hope. People can change. People do not always have to be imprisoned in previous predicaments.
I think we'll end on a source of hope. Please join me in thanking David Grossman.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.